This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 85, brought to you in association with Archover, Smart Pension, and Synchron. And I'm delighted to be joined today by David Clark, digital currency lead at Positive Money, to discuss money in the fintech age. Positive Money are the UK branch of a global movement to democratise money so that it works for society and not against it. They are working to tackle an issue that is at the root of many of the social and economic problems that we're facing today. The FT's chief economic commentator, Martin Wolf, has written in the FT in support of their approach. Our economic and financial problems run so deep that we need to get to the essence of what money is and how we make it in order to fix these problems. We will get back to how the nature of money is at the root of many of the issues in the show. But for now, we should note that the crash of crashes in 2008, or say the failure of the German Weimar Republic, which led directly to the Second World War, were both failures of money, or at least the monetary system. Additionally, however, our current monetary system of bullshit money causes problems at all times, not just in crises. Historians will write about these for centuries. I'll leave David to explain some of those, but to pick a simple example, as 97% of all money is created by private companies, i.e. banks, whose sole aim is to profit at an individual level, the aggregate monetary creation might not, and indeed is not, in the interest of society. To take the clearest example, as Lord Turner pointed out on the show, for an individual bank, especially given the Basel III regulations, it makes a lot of sense to lend against property. However, for society as a whole, huge increases in house prices have seen them go up, I'd guess around tenfold over my lifetime, massively widening the gap between the haves and the have-nots, both within generations and across generations. Now, what money is much misunderstood. A recent Bank of England paper provided three examples of this. As I like to ensure that the podcast can be mostly understood by anyone regardless of the background, I need to give more background than usual to get us all on the same page. So, in a slightly longer than usual introduction, I'll give an overview of the origin of money, what it has been and what it is. And then we can continue that thread in the show with how money is created today, what problems that causes, and how central bank digital cash might solve many of them. So, the origins of money. Physical coins first came around in about 600 BC. Cash is from a Tamil word for Chinese money. The word money itself originates from the Temple of Juno on one of Rome's seven hills. Cheques are from an Arabic word and were first used in Basra around 800 or 900 AD. Paper money has an interesting tale attached to it. In the 13th century, Marco Polo had an epic trip to Asia, including meeting Kublai Khan. His epic trip lasted 24 years. How does that compare to your recent holidays, eh? His holiday write-up, which in turn inspired Christopher Columbus, One Thing Does Lead to Another, Doesn't It?, included a chapter on a strange oriental magic. How the great Khan causeth the bark of trees, made into something like paper, to pass the money all over his country. Strange magic indeed, and one that it took centuries to surpass. As anthropologist David Graeber points out, anthropologists have been annoyed with economists for 200 years, ever since Adam Smith in 1776 speculated that money came around following prior barter systems. Anthropologists are annoyed as they have failed to find any evidence of this whatsoever in 200 years of searching, yet it's still in economics textbooks. Rather, in pre-money communities, and there are current examples, for example, David Graeber worked in remote Madagascar, everyone shared and lent stuff, real stuff, to each other. Every now and then there was a communal reckoning. The community would get together and reallocate everything to clear the slate and it would start again. Notice also the biblical debt jubilee concept where the slate was wiped clean. Compare that to the modern pyramid system of debt, where more always gets piled on top of more and those at the bottom of the system pay the most interest. Our forefathers knew the awful nature of interest, of course, hence all the religious bans on usury, lending at interest. So why money? The king, for example, owned, or could just take, all the gold mines in a country. Why would he take all that gold, make it into coins, and then ask for some of it back by way of tax? He could have just kept all the gold in the first place. So money actually came in, David Graeber tells us, when large armies needed feeding. And to give an example of that, Alexander's army required half a ton of silver a day to pay. So, types of money. Economists love to say that currency is a store of value. That would be nice, wouldn't it? But a dollar a century ago is worth only a cent now. Some store of value. How do we get here? There are three types of money: commodity money, representative money, and bullshit money, or for those economists amongst the audience, fiat money. Commodity money is worth something in itself, for example, gold and silver coins. We then move to representative money. A wealthy 16th century podcaster would have trouble carrying tons of gold around with him as small change, and so deposited it with goldsmiths, who would issue the podcaster with receipts for the gold. These receipts, representative money, could then be used by said podcaster to pay for the necessities of life, such as wenches and ale. The Bank of England was formed in 1694 in order to raise money for King William III's war against France. This is no radical slant for me, it's a direct quote from the Bank of England website. Like the goldsmith's notes, the crucial feature that made Bank of England notes a means of exchange was the promise to pay the bearer on demand the amount of gold in return for the notes, so we still got representative money. Perhaps the first clear slide into bullshit money was when yet more war led the Bank of England to stop paying gold for its notes between 1797 and 1821, after which it resumed exchanging. They had another naughty dip between 1914 and 1925, after which they gave it up for good in 1931, going off the gold standard. Let's quote Wiki. The gold standard, a monetary system where the medium of exchange are paper notes that are convertible into preset fixed quantities of gold, replaced the use of gold coins as currency in the 17th to 19th centuries in Europe. These gold standard notes were made legal tender, and redemption into gold coins was discouraged. By the beginning of the 20th century, almost all countries had adopted the gold standard, backing their legal tender notes with fixed amounts of gold. After World War II and the Bretton Woods Conference, most countries adopted fiat currencies that were fixed to the US dollar. The US dollar was in turn fixed to gold. In 1971, the US government suspended the convertibility of the US dollar to gold. After this, many countries depegged their currencies from the US dollar, and most of the world's currencies became unbacked by anything, which of course is bullshit money. It's literally worth nothing. A fact clearly shown when some countries, for example Burma and India, spring to mind, when the state decides to abolish all or some of it. We still have bullshit money, almost entirely created by private banks, which we'll come onto in the show. But the advent of computers has really turbocharged how much of this stuff banks create, with massive consequences. It's no exaggeration to say that bullshit money plus computers led to 2008. Over my lifetime, the US money supply has increased 40-fold. There is 40 times more money now than in 1962. An amazing stat is that in the UK, it took 300 years for the money supply to increase to £1 trillion, an astonishing mere 8 years to hit the second trillion. And you wonder why there are huge booms and busts and rampant house price inflation in your lifetime, listeners. So, and don't forget, we have got a show to come. Just a little wrap-up. What is money now? We all know there's two types of money. We have cash and notes in our pockets and numbers in our bank accounts. But actually, there's a third, which you and I won't come across unless we happen to be working in a bank. And here, there's a lot of interest in potential and how this might be expanded, including a paper by the Bank of England last year. This is central bank reserves. This is a type of money in its own right, but one which, up until now, only banks have been able to use. They have bank accounts with the Bank of England and settle them amongst themselves. The think tank Positive Money are a real force for good in educating. Reading their website clarified my thinking, and lobbying for change in all of this. And we'll come on to them as well as money. A recent survey showed that only 1 in 10 MPs know where money comes from. A phrase from the recent general election was that there are no magic money trees, but in fact there are. Positive Money's founder, Ben Dyson, is now economic research lead of digital currencies at the Bank of England. So that's another indicator that they're absolutely thinking along the right lines. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, David. Thanks for joining me today, and thanks for staying awake during all that introduction.
Hi, Mike. That was heroic. I feel like I'm twice as clever now.
Well, it was particularly heroic, as of course I made it all up off the top of my head, no notes whatsoever, which is extremely impressive. Anyway, sort of me recovering and you recovering and the listeners recovering from that 5,000 years of monetary policy in 5 seconds, you were telling me that you went to the Congo recently.
So for my summer holiday, I was partly in the Virunga National Park in the eastern Congo, which is just an amazing part of the world. Africa's oldest national park. It goes from the snow-capped ruins, Ori Mountains, to Lake Kivu, and it's got lots of like nature and biodiversity that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. Also, a very interesting place to witness the evolution of money and payments. So lots of people in East Africa are using mobile money services. So that's where you can store currency on your phone and make payments, make transfers to people just using the simplest of mobile phones.
Yes, it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, M-Pesa is the better known version. I don't think that's in the Congo, but it's a similar thing. And this had grown up from private sector behaviour, individuals not being able to settle money and transfer money very easily. In the early 2000s, were just transferring basically credit balances on their mobile phone to each other. And many years later, this got formalised into a system. So it's often interesting where innovation comes from. And this was a very prime example of where innovation comes from, people solving their own practical problems themselves, and then one day somebody commercialises it. So your career journey started by doing politics at university. And how on earth did you go from politics to becoming an expert on digital cash?
I studied politics because I want to change the world. And I realised, graduating just after the financial crisis, that there's a lot that politics can do, but there's also a lot that it can't unless it challenges the fundamental ways in which our economy and our financial system work. So that led me to work for Share Action, which is another organisation in the financial reform space trying to get pension funds to invest their money more responsibly, which is how I also got involved in Positive Money. I think that basically we can't build the fair and sustainable economy we need without fundamentally reforming the financial system. I've made my mission.
That's a great quote. We can't build a fair and sustainable system without changing how we're doing money. Well, let's get into money. There's quite a bit here, and we can only touch on some of the areas. I think the four areas in particular that I wanted you to help educate the listeners about were how we do have these, what I call inverted pyramids of money, of debt-based money, how private banks create money at the moment, some of the problems this leads to, and how central bank, electronic, digital cash, whatever you want to call it, might actually solve them. So just on the first one of those, inverted pyramids of money, and just continuing the history lecture theme from the introduction, I was really very interested to read on your website the 1844 Bank Charter Act story, which I think is a really good one, and reading that, it related very strongly to what happened in 2008, albeit in far more complex fashion.
So, as you mentioned in your introduction, there was a time when people were depositing their money, their cash, with Goldsmith bankers, and they were giving them receipts, and then people would go out and spend the receipts, which is basically like a way of banks just creating their own money. Gradually, the Bank of England sought a monopoly on the ability to create money, and that culminated in the passing of the 1844 Bank Charter Act.
And before we get to the 1844, it's worth noting one of the things that I didn't mention in my introduction, which is that originally, your 16th century podcaster would leave his ton of gold at a goldsmith and have a receipt for his ton of gold. But goldsmiths realised that your podcaster didn't really come back for his gold, and they started doing something a little bit naughty, and that has actually exactly led to all the financial problems we face today. And the little bit naughty thing was,
they would issue more notes than they actually had gold in their reserves. So they would create money out of thin air in the knowledge that people didn't turn up and ask for their gold back all at once.
Exactly, and people just started using the notes. So going back to this important shift from commodity money or representative money, which is a piece of paper saying there is a ton of gold in a store, this is the first example, centuries ago, of bullshit money. It's somebody literally starts by cheating the system and creating something which ends up being used as money, which actually is completely valueless. You know, you could have had a run on those goldsmiths in the same way you can have a run on the banks these days. And as you say, the Bank of England came along and all that kind of stuff, and lots of wars needed financing, yardy, yardy, yardy. But by 1844, this writing out notes on stuff that didn't actually exist and this massive inverted pyramid was causing huge problems.
So, yeah, it was increasing the amount of money in the economy, which pushes up prices, creates financial instability, as you mentioned. So the government realised they had to take away this power that banks had created for themselves to create money and transfer it back to the Bank of England. So they passed this 1844 Bank Charter Act, which stopped the creation of paper banknotes by banks. But what they missed out was other kinds of things which can basically be used as money. So like checks, for example. So if these banks were still lending money to people, then they could create deposits in people's bank accounts, which could then be transferred, not by the use of paper banknotes, but by checks, or then later on, other kinds of transfers, like electronic transfers or card payments, as we have now.
So The interesting thing about that is that one of the problems we have is this inverted pyramid of money, bullshit money that isn't real. This was recognised before the middle of the 19th century. Robert Peel's government tried to do something about it. And sort of with one of the ironies of history, if they'd drafted the 1844 Bank Charter Act a little better, then, well, things may have happened in the future, but that would have stopped all the problems that we see with money now. And I think I saw on your website some chap wrote to the FT in recent years suggesting that we update the 1844 Bank Charter Act. Of course, if we did that now, that would have massive repercussions on the banking sector, who would probably be busy lobbying against it. Anyway, the interesting thing about that is this inverted pyramid of money, which is going back to the goldsmiths. Your 16th century podcast is deposit is gold. The goldsmiths get a little bit naughty. Eventually, the banks take over, private banks take over from goldsmiths, and they're busy writing out more paper notes, more paper money than actually gold exists. So what isn't always particularly well understood, and as the Bank of England pointed out, often is misunderstood, is private banks. So sometimes I've had on the podcast people say that banks are a middleman. A wealthy podcaster like me deposits their money in a bank account, and some poor 20-something like you who needs to save $1 million to buy a shoebox to live in borrows it from the bank on the other side. That's not actually how it works, the Bank of England pointed out, and without going into a sort of one or two more misunderstandings of it. I think one thing that's worth explaining fairly simply is where money comes from. We all use money all the time, but we never actually stop and think where it comes from. Or if we do, we go to the YouTube and there's a sort of 1001 videos, all of which conflicting with each other, saying that sort of Rothschilds run the world, or the sort of the Federal Reserve is run by aliens, yada, yada, yada. But actually, it's much simpler than that. And the Bank of England has published a paper, and this is a paper that points out that in an important way, many university textbooks are wrong on this, so hence all the confusion. So if we can explain it very briefly, when we say that private banks can create money, how does that actually work, David? If a bank wants to create £5 to lend to you, how does it do it?
So it creates on its balance sheet both an asset and a liability. So it creates the promise to pay you £5 if you want to withdraw your money, and then in return it gets the knowledge that you're going to pay that money back at some point. But what that means is that the £5 that it creates in your bank account, it doesn't exist anywhere in the real world. It is just electronic imaginary money, which is technically the property of your bank. Only a small proportion of that electronic money exists as cash. Most of it just exists electronically, and you can go out and pay for things.
It was created out of thin air. Before electronics, we'll have plenty of time to talk about electronic things. Let's go back a bit to the time of quill pens and a big accounting ledgers, and let's try and remove the sort of assets and liabilities phrase for the moment for those people not familiar. And I think to a certain extent, the economics and the accounting terms hide what actually is fairly simple. Let's say I am a bank 100 years ago, long before computers, and I've got a big book in it, and I want to lend David £5. I write £5 in the book, and then on a little sort of sticker, I wrote, David owes me £5. And by an accounting sleight of hand, by accounting trickery, I then call that piece of paper that I've written on it, David owes me £5, an asset. And the accountants, curiously, and this is the thing the 1844 tried to stop, the accountants, curiously, are completely happy. So this is out of the thin air. And this is no exaggeration. So that 97% of money that exists at the moment is created by private banks. And that is precisely the process. They don't use little stickers. They don't use quill pens. But as you said, they use computers. But they literally can create it out of thin air. And this leads to a number of problems because, and this is a point that Adair Turner has been making for some time and has been focused upon, which is that bank regulation around the world, and he should know as he was chairing the Basel III committee, really focused on how you look after an individual bank and what an individual bank should do to be sensible. We can discuss or not how useful that was done and how successful it is. However, the most important thing, as I said in the introduction, is that what may make sense for a private corporation may not necessarily in aggregate add up to something that makes sense for society. Let's say you've got an economy and there's 10 banks in it. They can all act perfectly rationally, totally legally, very sensibly within the rules. Yet, and this is the point that's sort of at the leading edge of thinking at the moment, yet we end up with systemic crises as a result of this. So do you want to touch on some of the problems that this private bank money creation leads to? Because otherwise I think it just becomes a bit of an academic, oh, money's created this way, it could be created another kind of so what.
two problems basically with the banking system as we have it at the moment is that banks create too much money in good times. As Adair Turner says, like the 2008 crisis was basically a product of banks creating too much money.
By lending it. Banks create money by lending it.
And most of it goes to the wrong places. So the vast majority of money that banks lend goes towards property and financial speculation. So it's things which don't kind of boost jobs and wages in the real economy, don't create sustainable economic growth. And all this money going into property, particularly, pushes up house prices, which, as you mentioned, is like bad news for people like me who want to buy a house. Also kind of creates financial instability. And because the overall effect is to push up the value of assets, which are disproportionately owned by the wealthy, which means that it's also a big driver of inequality. So bad news on all fronts.
Yes, indeed. And I don't really know how to follow that because it's very clear and it's very accurate. When you've got a system such as ours, where central banks have for some time, and this made sense, targeted retail price inflation or consumer price inflation. And I say it made sense because in the 70s, with the oil shocks, inflation was really high. So surprise, surprise, banks wanted to clamp down on that. But the huge mistake of the 21st century, of the Greenspans and Volckers and all these guys, has been not to regard asset price inflation as anything to do with them. It was far better for everybody to say, oh, look, this is a measure of our success. But what it leads to is this massive increase in inequality amongst the 50-somethings. If you did okay a little while ago and you bought a house, then the value of a house went through the roof with you actually not actually doing anything to it at all. If you didn't do so well in your career and you're a 50-something, then you're left far behind. And there's also this intergenerational thing, which is why folks of my age talk quite a lot about the necessity to support their kids into their 20s and after the age of 18, university fees and all this kind of stuff. And if you talk to 50-something about what it was like in the 70s, 80s, the last thing you do would we ever go back to your parents again for money after the age of 18. You got a few quid for your grant, there were no university fees, and that was it. There was absolutely a mentality, a bit like little birds being pushed out of a nest, that you were supposed to fly then, and it's your responsibility to flap the wings. But these days, it just doesn't work like that, and the preoccupation of 50-something parents is how to get their kids going on the ladder. And again, those kids, fortunate enough to be born to parents who are fortunate enough to get on the ladder, may at some point have their parents keel over and inherit a house or two. But those that haven't, they're absolutely stuffed. And, you know, this kind of pyramiding can go on as much as you like. So the euro, we keep spending, or Europe keeps spending, vast sums of money to prop up the euro. And I'm reminded time and time again of a Native American saying, which is that the white man is the only man who steals from his grandchildren to feed himself. And that's actually what's happening at the moment. As I think an unintended consequence of the monetary system and these sort of pyramids of money, and I say an unintended consequence, but it's one that's kept going by politicians because having been around in this house price boom, politicians love seeing house prices go up because the electorate feels wealthy because they say, oh, we've got all this sort of money now because we've got more and blah, 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 and they vote the same politicians in who push it up. And exactly what we saw after 2008, you know, ways of trying to keep the house prices going up. So this is very dangerous. I think the other thing is that it does touch the whole thing in the economy, but I like your focus, David, on house prices and inequality. And as a number of people have been spotting, it's all very well the 0.01% getting infinitely wealthy, but sooner or later, the dispossessed burn their houses down. We've seen that time and time again in history. So that's all kind of the bad news about where we are. And I'd heard of positive money a few years ago, and you guys had some interesting proposals about how money should be reformed. And I thought, oh, that makes sense. If there was a sort of a referendum tomorrow, I'd vote for these guys. But I couldn't actually see any way that actually the whole system of creating money would be turned upside down overnight. It's a bit like everybody suddenly starts driving on the different side of the road. But the interesting thing is 2016, and very much associated with the fintech revolution, the Bank of England produced a paper on central bank digital cash, which is an expansion of this category that we don't know about as average members of the public, this third type of money which does exist. And I think that does open the door into a gradual change of the system. And as I said in the introduction, you're the expert on central bank digital cash. So maybe you'd like to give us a little bit of a background to that.
So we're seeing this complete evolution of money and payments. There's like all kinds of different new ways to pay for things and that technology is bringing about. So there's like digital currencies, mobile payments, innovations like contactless cards are gaining popularity. Cash is going to become, for the first time in history, not the most popular way to pay for things. But this raises big questions about who has control over this fundamental function of our financial system and who has access to it. So the move to electronic payments means that more and more we're relying on private financial institutions to access our money, whereas notes and coins, physical cash, are created under the Bank of England's supervision. And as we've said, like, the money in your bank account is technically the property of your bank and is created out of thin air. So, but leaving the payment system in the hands of these big banks means that we're all at risk from their risky lending activities, and banks have to be propped up by the taxpayer to make sure they're protected if the whole system collapses. So we want to take advantage of this new technology to take back control of our payment system in the public interest. And we're proposing that the Bank of England issues its own version of electronic cash, a central bank digital currency, where just like with normal notes and coins, you'd be able to store your money, send and receive payments without using a bank account.
And there's a lot to unpick in there. So just to reiterate the point, because it won't be familiar, and I want to run this home so it will be by the end of the show. In terms of money, there are three types of money at the moment. There's the cash notes we're all familiar with, there's the numbers in our bank accounts, and there's this central bank money, which we're less familiar with. Now, getting back to your point in a second, the Bank of England has actually recently created, I think, is it £500 billion more central bank money? You and I don't see it because it doesn't touch us. It's just to do with banks. And this is, of course, the infamous quantitative easing programme. So the central bank, the Bank of England at the moment, is extremely busy creating central bank cash. It's just been creating it for the banking system and not for the people. So the first point to note is that you guys are not talking about anything that isn't happening at the moment. The central bank has created a lot of this type of money. The interesting proposal comes from this 2016 paper about whether this category should be opened for more than just the banks and should be opened for the people. Now, that can be done directly. So, for example, in theory, we could all have an account at the Bank of England. I don't think the Bank of England would like this because of a whole bunch of reasons, that admin and treading on private banks' toes. And if we all had an account with the Bank of England, then the settlements you talk about could be extremely radical in that, you and I sort of touch our phones together and our bank accounts have changed at the Bank of England. Or it could be done by the private banks. This has a number of benefits, one of which is that the quantitative easing, and this is the Bank of England's work again, has itself massively increased inequality as it's pushed up house prices and financial assets and stock market. The Bank of England created £500 billion of money, which went basically into the financial system, and as well, I've forgotten the numbers now, 1% own 99% of the assets or whatever, some huge number like that, it's gone to them. So if we do this digital cash, there's not just the advantages you're talking about, but there's the possibility of doing what Keynes suggested was a possibility in the 30s and what Adair Turner has been going around lecturing for years and years on his book about, which is the helicopter money, which is a version of this quantitative easing, which listeners can now understand as just creating more central bank money, where it just goes directly to the people rather than the banks, when the central bank, acting in the good of the overall economy, not trying to make a profit itself, stimulates the economy not by stimulating the financial system, which is what's happened in the last 10 years.
So one of the potential advantages of having a central bank digital currency system is that you could guarantee everybody the right to have an account directly at the Bank of England. It wouldn't be administered by the Bank of England, so it's not like the Bank of England is going to start, opening up like shops on the high street, but it would be administered by agents, a digital cash account provider that might be the existing banks we have at the moment, or it might be new technology firms, mobile phone companies, for example. As you point out, one potential advantage of that is that it would provide the Bank of England with a way of giving people central bank money directly, which could be a new form of monetary policy. People call it helicopter money. If you want to stimulate the economy, you could just inject £1,000 directly into everybody's digital cash account. They'd go out and spend it and it would boost the economy.
Exactly. And that would boost the economy directly. It would make everybody in the country equally £1,000 wealthier, regardless of where they're coming from. and it wouldn't have this problem of boosting the financial assets. So there are a number of implementation issues around this, of course, and I'm absolutely not going to take the technology-led stuff about, oh, it's a blockchain. That's a type of technology in terms of how the Bank of England implements its spreadsheets, as it were, and bank spreadsheets and our spreadsheets. That's a detail. In terms of something that one hears about, and the Bank of England said in its own paper, there's a privacy concern is one of the concerns. The more that the state gets totalitarian, the more I become libertarian, which is that cash has great benefits, and in a world of increasing surveillance of everything, do I really want the Bank of England, the state, to know that I spent £5 at Monmouth this morning and absolutely everything I ever do?
Privacy is really important when designing this system. I think it's important to remember that at the moment, when the payment system is in the hands of a few big private institutions, there's massive privacy concerns about the collection and selling of data. It would be a priority in setting up a digital cash system or a central bank digital currency that concerns about privacy are mitigated. So one way of doing that is that if you're worried about the central bank collecting your data, that the instructions issued to the central bank from the companies managing your payments could be anonymized. So all the central bank needs to know is that money is going from one anonymized account number to another. They don't need to necessarily be collecting all the data about who's paying what to whom.
Yes, so there's lots of ways of implementing this, and like the design of all systems, it's the original intention that matters. So I think what you're saying is that where there's a will, there's a way. And if for the sake of argument, the Bank of England wants to start creating small amounts of digital cash as an experiment, it's creating enough of it as it is at the moment, but it's just sharing it with the private banks. But if it wants to share it with people, it can start doing that. And if it wants to do it in a sort of way that it maintains privacy with anonymized bank account numbers and all that, it can. I think that more broadly, there's a need for more of a society debate around what happens. So the Bank of England had said that one of the advantages of doing a digital cash would be that it could implement negative interest rates. And I have very strong views on this as well. Actually, I view negative interest rates as a complete outrage and yet another tax. It's a tax on your money. And let's say cash were abolished, which I hope it isn't, not abolished, it's never abolished, then negative interest rates would mean that after you work really hard and get taxed on your money when you earn it, you stick it in the bank. And then because cash has been abolished and we've got digital central bank cash instead, then the Bank of England can then set another tax on the money that you have at the moment, which is negative interest rates. And I think negative interest rates are just a symptom of the fact that our bullshit money has got in some sort of such a bloated, unfit state.
We talked about the problems with the ways that banks are lending money at the moment. And if you have negative interest rates, you're just trying to make them do even more of it. So it's kind of like, oh, you know, well, we haven't managed to solve this problem using a hammer, so let's bring out a sledgehammer instead.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's part of this thing I was saying. There was a very interesting presentation that basically said that, for sake of a metaphor, that central banks are spiritually bankrupt by now. They've run out of all the tools. If there was a 2008 crisis tomorrow, they couldn't use their one tool, which is cutting interest rates. And it really is more of the same about cutting negative ones. But anyway, so that's one of the challenges around this central bank cash. I think that is obviated to the extent that we would develop a monetary system, which is numbers in bank accounts are money. Central bank cash via somehow is money, but also cash and notes still exist, because then we could just sort of sit on a pile of notes and not actually use them. Or in practice, I suspect what would happen if they tried to implement that is your 21st century podcaster would go around and get a ton of gold and just deposit it at a goldsmith. And actually, history would actually come full circle, because for the sake of argument, just to make this completely obvious, let's say the economy gets more sort of Japanese in terms of deflation for 30 years and interest rates are minus 10%. I'll take my money out and I'll stick it with a goldsmith, because at least the gold goes back to commodity money itself. So it's really just the challenge around the system. And I think one of the things that I quite liked, it's a point that's been discussed around helicopter money, is a parallel between how Iceland and America handled the 2008 crisis. In that, roughly speaking, in America, they gave the banks lots of money to float them and they bankrupted the people. Whereas in Iceland, they bankrupted the banks and looked after the people. And it's a very strange state of abstraction that we live in at the moment, which I think is caused by our frontal cortex taking abstractions as reality, in that, in human being terms, all there are, quotes unquotes, on the planet, forgetting the animals, is people. They're just individuals. You look outside, they're walking down the street as individuals. But society is not structured around those individuals. It's structured around these very abstract things called corporations, and we all take them for real, as I say, because of our frontal cortex, we can take what is abstract as real. But again, going back to the deep roots of these things, there is an extent to which we need to think a little bit more like Iceland in terms of be thinking first of the people, and then secondly, these abstract collectives that they sort of people go into and go out of. And it doesn't matter whether it's BP or HSBC or anything like that. We have got it orientated around that. So we've talked about a lot of stuff here, and I think the interesting thing is this chink in the armour, is this potential way forward. I gave a long history preamble at the beginning, really, to point out that, in a way, nothing is new under the sun. It was a pyramid of debt and bullshit money in some very complicated fashions, all, you know, this CDO squared and all that. It's just bullshit stuff that led to 2008 crisis. As you said, in terms of the real world, i.e. people you see walking down the road, some of those people are screwed by virtue of their parents or their age, which pains me no end. If we keep going down the current system, we are exacerbating that. That's what the Bank of England has said about its own QE programme. We're exacerbating this. Coming back to what you said about starting off by having done politics university, I absolutely buy your personal journey here, which is that we need some pretty radical change with fintechy stuff and with central banks looking at this and scratching their head. And there are some very clever people in there. As I mentioned at the beginning, Ben, who founded Positive Money, is now the chief advisor in there. So actually, a lot of this thinking is really going on at the moment. And as Lord Turner said when he was on the show some time ago, it's really important that the thinking gets worked out, that enough people understand it. So then it's, as it were, it's a buffet laid out that politicians or policymakers can pick up at the next time. All of Mervyn King, last governor of Bank of England, Lord Turner, last head of the FSA, and the likes of John Kaye, a new senior economic commentator at the FT, all of these three think that the 2008 crisis will happen again. And so we hope that next time around, a more radical version is going to be picked up. Or if we're going to avoid that, then we need central banks to experiment a little bit more with this, what I want to call, non-pyramiding version of money, that a central bank, as part of the state, creates the appropriate amount of money for society as a whole. And I'm not talking about any crazy socialist schemes here. I'm just talking about a simple thing, which is like, in a recession, it doesn't reduce the amount of money. Whereas at the moment, in a recession, the amount of money reduces because the banks call in their loans and all money is debt at the moment. So we've covered quite a lot, David. Before we wrap up a little bit about Positive Money, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I hope you haven't needed too many paracetamol to get through this episode. And I hope it's given you plenty to think about. We couldn't possibly touch on all the stuff here, but I wanted to give you a little bit of a taste of what's out there and things that you might be interested in. In particular, Positive Money, I've got some very short YouTubes, about 5 minutes each, which are very authoritative and very simple and very clear about how money is created. So I'd really recommend that you check those out. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, secure peer-to-peer business lending, connecting businesses requiring finance with investors seeking a secure and favourable return of up to 9% per annum. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. Synchron, digital, business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 7,000 people, 18 countries and $400 million of revenue. So David, before we wrap up with Positive Money and where you are and what you're going and how folks can get involved, in a very technical topic like this, maybe I can bring it back to your career journey and you saying that your motivation post-university was to try and change the world for the better. Abstracting from all the complicated stuff, what are you trying to do here with your sort of work in digital cash? What's your pipe dream about, you know, what it would lead to? If you were the butterfly's wings, your work here, what would the outcome be?
I think that we're at this really crucial moment in the evolution of money and payments, where we can either go one way, which is increasingly just giving up our control of the payment system to financial private institutions, which exclude people, which provide us with a poor service, which require taxpayer funding to get bailed out and to protect our deposits. Or we can design a system which helps to support a more fair and sustainable economy. I think that part of that is through the bank having a central bank digital currency, which everybody is guaranteed the right to use, is free to use, our money is safe, and it can be much more competitive. Like, we can have many more new participants in the system, which can give people a better deal. So I think this is an opportunity we've got to seize, and that's what our work at Positive Money is about.
Excellent. Well, I really buy into that, and I entirely agree that, you know, if we keep going along the same lines of just sort of bloating in more inverted pyramids on more inverted pyramids and continuing regardless. Then we will... if you always do what you always did, you always get what you always got, and in spades. But I do think, as you indicate, that there is a door opening for something which might diminish this. And we're not talking about scrapping banks or anything like that. We're just talking about the central bank expanding the usage of one of the three types of money and seeing how that goes, and banks carry on being bankers, but in a more stable fashion. And in terms of how this affects everybody, we all had to, all of us taxpayers, had to bail out the banks in 2008. And I've been in the city long enough to remember a system when this is pre-big bank, stockbrokers were stockbrokers and merchant banks were merchant banks and commercial banks were commercial banks. And there's no reason that we can't go back to the future and have a financial system where, rather than some vast conglomerate where private taxpayers are required to back some vast, vast organisations that do a huge range of things and are too big to manage and too big to fail, we go back to a system where it's more speciated, where there are a bunch of banks involved in, they may still be creating money as we do at the moment, but maybe half the money is created by them and half the money by the central bank. And they're kind of ring-fenced in a narrow banking fashion, which everyone sensible I've ever come across wants. And then you've got a whole bunch of folks busy doing the speculation and free market stuff as they wish. But if they fall over, it doesn't matter. The shareholders lose out, but it doesn't impact the monetary base of the economy. So I think this is very worthy work, and I'd like to wish you every success. And just briefly finishing up with, I've mentioned that folks can check out your YouTube in particular, which I found very good. How else can they get involved? I'm very impressed by the number of sort of meetups and things you have around the country and the international network.
Yeah, come along to one of our local groups. We've got 30 around the country. People get together, campaign for a more fair and sustainable money system, educate each other. Go on our website, positivemoney.org. You can sign up to our mailing list, regularly get in touch with ways that you can campaign. And yeah, join our movement. We've got 50,000 people around the world, the international movement for money reform.
And this is 24 countries. So this is quite a big thing that's going on at the moment, and it dovetails very well with the fintech world and thinking about currencies afresh. And it may well be that things like Bitcoin end up being two things. One is sort of a very interesting computer science experiment, which students will have to read about in 50 years' time. But the second, actually, prompting central banks to think outside the sort of box they've been thinking in for centuries and have a little bit of that for themselves. And I'm particularly impressed by your personal motivation. We read all this crap online about millennials nonstop and the me generation, narcissism and all that kind of stuff. And there's so much of this sort of identity politics and lumping everybody in boxes, which I really despise. But you're a prime example of where all this millennial stuff is a load of crap, in that you've so far devoted yourself to trying to make the world a better place, which is a very noble thing. And I hope you succeed. But even if you don't succeed, by the time you're my age or twice my age, you can sit in your rocking chair thinking that you did your best, which is a very worthwhile aim. So I wish you every success and positive money, and suggest that listeners keep their ears pricked up for central bank digital cash, and maybe they've learned a little bit more about it, or at least whetted their curiosity. So thank you very much for that, David.
Thanks, Mike. Pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance with me.